Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Niro plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Joe at rt.ie and 1850 715 815, and 51551, wash your hands, it's the text number. Now, just a little warning that the topic at the start of the program today, it relates to abuse of children by an adult. In this case, it's a former Jesuit priest. We spoke about it yesterday on the program. Father Joseph Marmion, a Jesuit who died in the year 2000. We have Luke on the line. We'll have Mark Harold on the line. And we'll have Tom Durley on the line. I'll begin with Luke, if I can. Luke, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
How are you doing? You okay?
I'm okay. A little bit nervous, but yeah. I'm okay.
Okay. One of the things we're trying to put together here is the timeline of the abuse that Father Marmion perpetrated when he was in Belvedere and Clongowes Jesuit schools, and the revelation by the Jesuits. Now, they named him this week, but apparently they say they knew or they heard about it in 1977.
Yes.
When did you become a victim of Joseph Marmion?
Well, it would have been when I went into what was then the senior house, Joe. I would have gone through the junior house, and then about 1972-ish, 73 maybe, went into the senior house, secondary school. And it was there that I would have had a reasonably good voice, a good singing voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the singing class.
Okay.
And Joseph Marmion was the priest who was running the singing class. And this was probably with a view to children being picked out to sing in the opera.
Okay.
And that would have been, I'd say 1973 from my memory. It started really with probably being singled out after school for a little bit of extra tuition, which was singing scales, you know, do, re, mi, and going up to the next scale and moving up like that. He would then instigate kind of intimate conversations with you, asking you about your family life, your mother, your father, and then asking you about, you know, your thoughts. You know, do you ever have, you know, private thoughts or that you want to talk about, you know, facts of life and stuff that. Another thing I remember distinctly was, I remember one time putting his hand on the piano and placing my hand on his, and what he was trying to show me was how his hand could span an octave on the piano, and how small my hand was in comparison to these, as Tom Durley described them, hams of hands. They were enormous. From that, then, I mean, the opera, we would be practicing the various different tunes of the opera. When it came round to the opera, there was then the costume. You'd be trying on costumes.
Okay.
He would bring you over to a room, which, from my memory, was called Number 9, and it was located where the theatre is now.
Okay, in Belvedere College.
In Belvedere College. So you'd walk across the yard under an arch, turn right, and you walked up these steps. And at the ground floor, there was a music room. I think there was a piano into the left. Now, his what I would describe as a lair was either on the next floor or the floor above that again. And in that room were costumes. And there was some, from my memory, there was some sort of screen there as well, but there are certainly costumes on rails. I remember being brought into this room, and this happened on a number of occasions, being brought into the room, and there was a towel on a bench. Mm-hmm. There was also a towel on the floor, and he'd ask you to take your clothes off. because we were trying on these costumes. And also there was a bar heater, one of these electric bar heaters on the floor as well. So the room was warm. Mm-hmm. So I was 12 or 13 at the time. And so you take your clothes off.
Completely, Luke. He would ask
completely.
You
to- Yeah. Completely.
Yeah. Okay.
Completely. So, okay. And like, and compliantly, I did this. Mm. And innocently thinking all that was happening here is I'm trying out a costume.
Okay.
So what he would do is pull on a pair of tights on you. And I remember him, like, running his hand up your leg onto your bottom while he's pulling up these tights. But then he would disappear behind this screen or the rails of costumes. And he would come back then, 3 minutes, while you're sitting there. Mm. He'd come back. Now, it never occurred to me until recently what he was up to behind the screen. It just never occurred to me at all. Mm-hmm. All I remember was being so uncomfortable about the position that I was in. But he was obviously masturbating behind the screen because he'd come back flushed. And this happened in 1973, 1974, around that time. Now, what prompted me to agree to speak with you was reading the statement that was made by the Jesuits, and they saying that they only first, it was brought to their attention in 1977. That is an untruth as far as I can go, because I was asked by a priest in there around 1974 what was happening in that building number 9. And I'm pretty sure I gave, it probably was a vague description because it was embarrassing to talk even to another priest about this. To this priest. So there was an awareness of what was going on, and they cannot deny that.
And you say that was clear. And your description, Luke, is just incredible in terms of the, for a 12-year-old, the trauma.
Well, 12, 13,
The trauma you were going through, and everything that's seared into your memory of the images, the small bar heater, the rail, the piano to the left.
It was his sickly soft tone as well when he was talking to you. And that it was that juxtaposition of how you saw he could behave with children, asking, like, he could be violent, or not so much violent, but instigate violence in a classroom. He would
that image, Luke, just come back, because that image is powerful as well. His hand on the piano straddling an octave, which is eight
notes.
Fingers on a piano.
Yeah.
And he puts your hand on his hand.
Yes.
You're 12, 13. What was he up to there? Well, yesterday's description was that he was a very big man, a gregarious man, larger than life, great welcome for himself. But this image of your little hand on his massive, Tom described him in his article as hands of hands, shovels of hands.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. What was he saying? What was he?
This was a power thing, Joe.
Okay.
This was, you're small, I'm big. You know. Now all of this was done in a very gentle tone.
Yeah.
You know, he was an incredibly manipulative man, a very intelligent man. My understanding is, although I never had him for German or French, he spoke two languages. He was a very, very bright man. He arranged the music every year, and that was no mean feat for the opera. And
what was it yesterday we heard, Luke? He translated was it the Beggar's Opera from German into English, and and arranged all the music accordingly, or rearranged all the music accordingly, whatever we do.
Yes.
And we know anyone who's any contact with Belvedere and beyond Belvedere, because their theatre is open to the public a lot of the time, it has an incredible record and tradition when it comes to musical shows, doesn't it? It's a big part of college life.
It does, and it was. But I remember how he dealt with some of the other teachers there as well. There was one teacher who you refer to as Mary, a lovely man, a really decent man, and he referred to him as Mary in front of the other children. And there was this power thing going on, bullying, not only with the children, but with other teachers. And I have a feeling that the teachers were, or the other teachers and priests were just cowering before him. They were afraid of him. But certainly, Joe, I had been approached by one of the other priests there and asked specifically about this. Now, and I might have been giving vague answers as a 13-year-old, because it was an embarrassing question to be asked by anybody, and not really having a complete understanding. I mean, at 13, you're waking up to lots of different things.
But do you think, Luke, in that conversation, which you believe, and you're very precise and concise about trying to locate the dates, but you're adamant it was way before 1977. Was that conversation initiated by the priest?
Yes.
Okay. So they.
I did not go to them saying I was feeling uncomfortable about this.
They came. In other words, they must. There was something. Something prompted that conversation. Between that priest and you.
I have no doubt that they were aware of this man.
They say they weren't following receipt of information from concerned parents in 1977. Disclosures of sexual abuse were received by the school.
No, they knew what was going on in advance of that. Well in advance of that. Like, there were rumours, I can tell you this as well. When the school used to organise trips abroad. And I remember on one trip, I was in France with the school and chatting with two lads who were below me in Belvedere, a year below me in Belvedere. And they mentioning jokingly about the Austrian trip that Joe Marmion used to bring children on. And the method by which he used to take their temperature, which was rectally. And this was, and he would have no reason to be doing this whatsoever. But I'm not sure of the veracity of that, but it was a joke amongst, not a joke, that could be the wrong way, it was the chat amongst us 12, 13, 14-year-olds at the time. So where did that rumour emanate from? That question has to be asked.
Yeah.
If this was the chat amongst us 13 and 14-year-olds, where did that come from? Where was the source of that? I have no doubt that there was truth in that.
Yeah.
That has yet to be revealed.
I know the Jesuits got credit for this yesterday. When the statement was released, people were saying, some commentators were saying, it's fair play to Jesuits. They're saying clearly this was a predator. He sexually and emotionally abused children. His name was Joseph Marmion. They didn't hold anything back. But now it looks like, from what you're saying and other people are saying, that the dates don't coincide, to say the least. Now, they do say after they received this information from parents in 1977, disclosures of sexual abuse in the school. A decision was taken. I'm like, why wouldn't you ring the guards? But anyway, a decision was taken that Joseph Marmion be removed from the staff in Belvedere with effect from the end of the academic year. So are they saying they got the complaint at the end of the academic year, or they waited till the end of the academic year before moving him in case they might embarrass him or someone else? Nonsense.
Yes.
He then spent a year on sabbatical in Paris with the Jesuit community, Saint-François Xavier. He was then assigned to the Gardiner Street Jesuit community, which runs a church there. That's the big church there. And in 1919, this is the one we heard yesterday from one of our callers, he was appointed chaplain to St. Vincent's Private Hospital, We recognise that these subsequent appointments should not have been made. Why weren't the Gardaí called in 1977? Why weren't they called before that? But why weren't they called at least when they say we knew in 1977?
Yeah.
And the other thing to be aware of, which is the in the schools run by Jesuits or indeed any religious order, the invariably, now this is changing, I know, but invariably, if you were a member of the religious order that ran the school, you were regarded as superior to anyone else in the school. In other words, for a long, long time, it's changed recently, I know, but for a long, long time, the principal in Jesuit schools had to be a Jesuit and Mara schools or whatever.
Yes.
And in other words, even if that principal, even if that person, I'm sure they were brilliant, but even if that person only had 4 years experience and there was a teacher in the school with 24 years experience, the Jesuit would be preferred over the lay person.
Well, here's the thing, Joe. The Jesuits prided themselves on having what they... the best priests, the most intelligent priests. They went through the longest period to become a priest, as far as I'm aware, of nearly all orders. And yet, at the end of that, they have a problem with what is right and what is wrong. You know, and this is what the essence of this is. They did the wrong thing.
You're right about the Jesuits, because isn't there that whole... Again, it's in one sense it's buried in time, but for I'm especially thinking of younger people. But the Jesuits were regarded as more philosophical, this Ignatian teaching. You're right to pinpoint that. By the way, if you had said it to your parents, Luke, what did they think of the Jesuits?
Well, if you don't mind, Joe, I prefer not to. Okay. Talk about if that's okay.
That's absolutely fine.
Yeah,
absolutely
fine. I'm just relating to you my story.
Okay,
you know, such as it is, and I'm hoping that from what I hear, there are many others, and I'm hoping if they're listening, that they will take some solace that you know there is healing.
Yeah,
and I know from what I experienced, there are, I believe, worse situations that other lads would have encountered.
Okay, you mentioned... stay with us, Luke, please, because Tom Durley has been listening and Mark Harrell has been listening. I'll go to Tom first. People know Tom, of course, from the restaurant and his whole food and cookery persona. Tom Durley, but you were also a student in Belvedere, Tom.
I was indeed, Joe. I have to say, compared to the stories I've been listening to just now and over the past week and having written about them in last Saturday's Irish Daily Mail, I waltzed through Belvedere in relation to Marmion. I knew he was a bully. I knew about the sexual abuse. Everybody did, but I would like to stress that, you know, compared to Luke and others, I got off very, very lightly. Mm-hmm. One thing Luke said there, and I think his testimony is great. He sent a cold shiver down my spine when he described perfectly Marmion's voice, this deceptively gentle yet menacing voice. And I think Luke's account of the contrast between Marmion's hand and his little one. Mm. Is very telling because, as Luke says, what that was meant to say was, you know, I'm big, you're small, I have all the power, you've got none. And in relation to who knew what when, which is a big question, it's interesting that Luke isn't the only person I've spoken to in recent days who have recounted being asked about inappropriate behavior or whatever phrase was used to describe what Father Marmion was up to. And at least two such boys have said to me that such was Marmion's hold over them, such was their terror of him, that they actually denied that anything had happened.
Yeah.
So one of the dreadful things about Marmion, who I believe was the personification of pure evil, incidentally, he was I mean, we know that he raped, drugged and raped children. We don't know how many. I would imagine much fewer than had gone through the terrible experience that Luke described there. But certainly there are victims of that gravity, some of whom are probably not still with us. I just don't know. But such was his hold, such was his extraordinary personality, that one of his, and I hate to use the word victim, I'm going to say one of his targets, who confessed to an older boy what had happened to him, and it was at the higher end of the abuse scale that we're talking about here. When he was approached by the then headmaster to ask, you know, is it true what you told X? And he said he suddenly realized that Marmion's phrase was always deny everything. And he said, I knew I was lying, but I denied it. And that headmaster had the wisdom to realize that he was lying, that in fact it was true. But I think this is something we're inclined to forget, is that incredible power that we have. Because we hear about teachers and priests in other schools, boys going to their parents or to headmaster and saying, this happened to me, and not being believed. But here we have a case of a man who's, I think Alan Glynn, the novelist, described as his miasma of evil was such that even when asked what had happened to them, they'd say, no.
Yeah.
Nothing
fear,
happened.
Fear.
Absolute, I mean, more than fear, Joe. Absolute naked terror is what that man put people through, and he put people through worse than that.
The other thing I'm thinking, Luke, when they sent, I'll come back to you in a sec, Tom, and Tom, I want to quote some of the incredible descriptions in terms of how vivid they are that you use in your article. But Luke, I should remind people that I say he was sent, he was transferred then to Gardiner Street, and I said Gardiner Street is right beside Belvedere College. He wasn't very far from the college when they actually decided to penalise him, after they did say we, in 1977, they heard. But anyway, that was Mark Harold. Mark, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
You were in Belvedere from 1969 to 1979.
I was.
And
I
you
was.
Were you aware of what the Jesuits are now admitting openly? He was a sexual abuser. He was a paedophile. He physically and sexually abused children in Belvedere, in Clongowes, as far as they know. They say they found out in 1977. Were you aware of this man's behaviour, Mark, in any shape or form?
Well, I have sort of two perspectives on it at this stage of my life, Joe. One, I was one of his targets, not from a sexual abuse point of view, but from a physical and emotional perspective. I'll tell you that in a moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm a clinical psychologist, have been for the last 35 years. But my own experience, I was in a German class, and one of his ruses was to identify someone, and he would say, get Harold, and the whole class would go and kick and punch the person until they cried and they were in pain, and then he would call them off. Now, this is the kind of power that this chap had over individuals. Now, the day he did it to me, I was a chunky prop on the junior cup team, and I was stood up and I was going to go for the first person that arrived at me, and they all sat down. And I subsequently got a note to the principal, and I was removed from that German class. And this is what these cowards do. If you challenge their authority, then they banish you from their sinister world. Because his usual prey were the only children, more vulnerable children, children he might perceive as being weak, and you know, somebody sent me one of the brochures from one of the operettas there at the time in about 74. And I could have cried going through the names of the lads who were in it. All gentle, lovely kids, basically. But Joe, we can maybe quote numbers or hear about boys, you know. But could I just for a moment imagine, just ask your listeners to imagine what it was like for that 12-year-old walking into that dark room with all their hopes, their aspirations, that, you know, their optimism that their parents would have done. And let's face it, a good half of the people who went there, including my own parents, spent every last penny they had to get the best education possible. And this young boy standing in front of this monster, being stripped naked, and you heard his ruse. That was it. I've heard numerous people, ex-pupils, friends of mine, describe exactly the same routine. It's not unique to Luke. And then, so they're absolutely, their aspirations destroyed. Then they're pushed out into the back out into the schoolyard, and then the word is nothing happened. That did not happen. What you just encountered there didn't happen to you. Now, what that could do to the mental health of a child, you know, at the, you know, 12 years of age, then they move on to, you know, the church to hear about you're going to be men for others, you know, deep Christian values, all of this sort of stuff, and the incongruity of it. And that's why I have to tell you, Joe, the people I have spoken to in the last week, they still remember everything vividly. One friend of mine who wanted to speak somewhere in public said, I have a heart condition. I can't, and I'm too upset. I can't come forward. I simply am not able to. And then I suppose the final insult, Joe, 45 years on, and believe you me, I remember vividly that day when he turned a class on me. I remember it so vividly, 45 years on. But I think to compound the insult is this crafted, you know, PR-worked statement, which is trying to suggest that nobody knew, you know, and that's just compounding the insult, or that somebody came forward in 2019. The dogs in the street knew this from the early 70s, and Luke was able to attest to that. We all knew it was happening, and nobody did anything. Nobody did anything. And I think that's the real insult. So I would call on the, you know, the community, some of whom are my friends, to stop fudging. Stop using your PR woolly words, and admit that huge failings occurred to innocent children, many of whom's lives were destroyed. The people who you're hearing from now are the ones who made it through, who probably have the resilience. We don't know how many committed suicide. We don't know how many have addiction problems or have, you know, have had relationship issues that they have never been able to form relationships. But we do need to stop and think about what it must have been like for that 12-year-old in that room and the absolute terror that that child would have encountered.
Okay. Stay with us, Luke, Tom Durley and Mark Harald. We're talking about Father Joseph Marmion, this statement issued by the Jesuit order in Ireland. They're a worldwide order, as you know, 400 or 500 years old. The Pope is a Jesuit, and I know on their website they say, inspirational Jesuits, Pope Francis, a humble Jesuit, a rarity, a Jesuit Pope, an impossibility, a humble Jesuit Pope, a miracle. That's their, anyway, it's just a phrase, I suppose. Back after this, 51551, my chance.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Joe at RT.ie. Yesterday we heard from people who worked with Father Joseph Marmion, a Jesuit deceased. He died in the year 2000. This is on foot of a statement from the Jesuit order in Ireland admitting that he sexually, emotionally and physically abused boys when he was on the teaching staff at Belvedere College and in Clongowes College, and that's where we're going now. Clongowes is another Jesuit school in Kildare. And Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
How are you? Do you remember Joseph Marmion?
Well, I think everybody that encountered Joe Marmion remembers him all right.
And what is the colour of your memories, Brian?
Well, it's the man was, he was sadistic. He enjoyed beating people. Now, I fortunately didn't have too much of a nasty encounter with him from the point of view, from that point of view. I did, like I think nearly everybody, have occasion, all right, when he would have administered what was called the Pandy Bat in Clongowes and in Belvedere, I believe, as well. But there were certainly classmates of mine who really did suffer at his hands.
Do you mean physically?
Physically suffer, yeah, okay, as already been detailed.
And what did he use a cane or a strap, or what did he use?
No,
a
specially designed leather strap, which was called a Pandy Bat.
A Pandy Bat?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've lost that. And when you say specially designed, you mean in shape or in material?
Yeah, it's a shape. It was shaped a little bit like an elongated kidney, for want of a better word.
Okay. And this is what he'd slap you on the hand with?
Well, not only on the hand, but on the bare backside as well, or, you know, depending on what was termed the severity of the sentence. It determined whether it was on the hand, whether you got 4 on one hand, or 8, or 12, or whatever it was, or then it graduated up to on with your pants still on to your pants, you know, taken down.
I guess. And other pupils, other boys would witness this?
I'm not aware that was done in front of others. He usually took you into his office, okay, and that's where you really, you know, you were there on a one-to-one basis.
Oh, God.
And I did subsequently encounter him. I happened to be in St. Vincent's Hospital.
Okay.
This was when I didn't realise it at the time. He was chaplain there, and I was recuperating after an event, and I was walking down the corridor, and the next thing I see this vision ahead of me, and I just turned on my heel. I would have been about 40 at that stage. I turned on my heel and went back to, you know, the ward.
And can you remember, Brian, was that anger, fear?
Oh, fear. He instilled fear into everyone.
Wow. At 40 years of age, you were still... By the way, what year were you in St. Vincent? Can you remember, Brian? Approximately.
It was in the late 1980s.
Okay, because he was still ministering then in the late 1980s, even though on the admission of the Jesuits, it's interstatement, so we presume they regarded them as valid. Well, they did. The first information about sexual abuse was in 1977, which is 11 years beforehand. Luke has given an extraordinary testimony today that I don't think anyone could refute, in terms of him being asked in 1974 about what Marmion was up to by another Jesuit, and Luke explaining, and Luke's explanation would give anyone cause for concern, but nothing was done until 1977. And then again, in 1977, nothing was done except he was moved.
Par for the course, I think, in those times, unfortunately.
Yeah. But I don't want to labour the point that the Jesuits do hold themselves to a higher, they say anyway, in terms of the novitiate, you know, the first year is novitiate, the second year is philosophy, the years of study are normally greater, they say, longer than in the priesthood. But anyway, that's
probably... I don't see that as being relevant,
okay,
you know, really.
Okay. And Brian, what was Marmion's expression when he was beating boys?
You could see a look in his eye that he was enjoying this.
God. Did you get a letter, Brian, to the old, what is the phrase, the old Clongonians?
No, I haven't received that as of yet, anyway.
Dear old Clungonians, you may be aware through the media that a communication has been issued by the Society of Jesus about the historical abuse of past pupils of Belvedere, our sister school, by a Jesuit teacher in the late 1970s. Now, you're adamant he was abusing, physically at least. You didn't, in fairness, you didn't witness anything else, but he was physically abusing boys in Clongowes.
Was he in the 1960s? Yes, definitely. But then corporal punishment was, unfortunately, was endemic in Irish schools.
I know.
The 60s and before that.
Did you ever hear, Brian, did you ever hear allegations of sexual abuse of boys when he was in Clongowes?
No, I can't say that I did.
That's fair. Okay. Stay with us, Brian, if you would, please. Because, Mark, Harold, I want to ask you about these trips to Austria. When we know he was a German teacher and translator, so Austria would have fitted in terms of language. And two, that he was into music. But we don't know if he's into music or he was using music to get at young boys in the various rooms he used to take them, including the costume room. What were the trips to? Were they school trips, Mark?
Yes, they were. Yeah, it was third, I think, and fourth year.
So how many pupils and how many teachers would go on that?
Well, my recollection, because one of my brothers went on one of these trips, was there was about 20 to 25 boys and just himself to Austria. He would avidly monitor the boys for any slight sneeze or, you know, rash or anything like that. And I've had testimony, you know, one of the people I have spoken to since this all broke out, of somebody being, you know, a minor medical issue, being removed to his bedroom. And they would remain there for up to 48 hours. Something I hadn't heard, but it was mentioned to me. Again, I can't sort of confirm this, but certainly I've heard it from more than one source that there were children who were brought into that room and drugged, because they came out of the room then with absolutely no memory of what happened the previous 24 to 36 hours. But I wasn't aware of that until recently. What I do know is, though, the rectal thermometer temperature taking being touched all over, including private parts, but that nobody else was allowed to go near that room while the boy was in the bedroom.
And Marmion, were these trips for a week or a fortnight, Mark? Do you remember?
It would be at least a fortnight, I'd say. Yeah.
And he was the only adult?
That's my recollection, yeah. And it seemed that he had carte blanche to do this. This is what's sort of so... I mean, we're talking about it now, Joe, but the people have held on to this for 45 years, you know. But... you know, that this was happening, people just couldn't get their heads around it, and yet it was happening, and people were aware. This chap had carte blanche to engage. Now, he was a bully, and as Tom related there, he was a bully within his own community. We get that. But nobody had the courage to step forward and say, enough is enough. And that's what's so disappointing about the state.
And you reckon he was bullying other confreres?
Yes. Yeah. I would think so.
Yeah, who wants to come in? Sorry, whose voice is
that's
that?
That's
Tom. Tom, come in, Tom.
Actually, it wasn't me, but I can certainly say that was true.
In your article, Tom, you say in the Mail last Saturday, he destroyed lives. You list, and Mark referred to it as well, about we don't know what happened to other boys in terms of their subsequent lives. You mentioned the trips to Austria, which are bizarre. Obviously, Tom, they were planned with a purpose.
Absolutely, and a very sinister purpose. It's interesting that, as I understand it, it was Vienna that proved to be his undoing. Something happened in August 1977 on that trip he brought to Vienna, which involved a boy being drugged and taken to his room, and as Mark says, being unaware of anything for the next 36 hours.
Crimes. These are crimes. These are savage crimes.
These are huge crimes. You've referred to somebody who's gone through the formation of the Jesuit training. He joined the order in 1942, and he was ordained in 1957. But that's neither here nor there. Mm. These are huge crimes. And it was on that Vienna trip that at least one younger boy disclosed to an older boy, a very slightly older boy, what had happened to him.
Right.
Interestingly, what had happened to him the year before. But as he said, he came back the second time because he was in such thrall to this monster. He actually came back, if you like, not for more, but he was persuaded to come a second time. And that set in train a series of events which were investigated and led to Marmion being
given a year in Paris.
He was given a year's notice to serve out as a teacher in the school with
You reckon he was given a full year in the school?
Oh, he was. Yes.
Oh my God.
I think my fellow OBs here will corroborate that, because my understanding is that it all blew up at the beginning of the autumn term in 1977.
Yeah.
And he remained in harness, but with certain very strict preconditions, to be fair, until the following June.
Yeah, you're right.
Of 1978.
He was removed. A decision was taken. Information from concerned parents, disclosure of sexual abuse, 1977. In consequence, a decision was taken that Joseph Marmion be removed from the staff of Belvedere with effect from the end of the academic year 1977-78.
Exactly, yeah. And what was interesting...
So not only did they... and the whole shadow that sits over all of this is is the points that Luke made so strongly, that it was 1974 when he disclosed to a Jesuit. But even when they now admit they received the disclosures, they don't say allegation, the disclosure of sexual abuse in 1977, they left them up. They didn't dial 999 or run around to Fitzgibbon Street Garda Station and 500 yards away. They actually left them on the staff for another year.
Yeah. And do you know the really horrifying thing about that, apart from the sheer irresponsibility of it, is I've spoken to some of his victims who had disclosed what had happened to them, which was very, very difficult, including some from his final Vienna trip. They had to sit in class and be taught by this monster for that academic year.
German,
can you imagine, after that experience, after the trauma of having to talk about it, and thankfully being believed, to be fair, but they then had to daily see this monster in a position of authority over them. I think that beggars belief.
And apparently he also taught in Crescent College in Limerick. Stay with us back after this break. Joe at RT.ie, we're talking about Father Joseph Marmion. We had calls yesterday. One, it began with a call from a family of another priest called Father Joseph Marmion. They were in the west of Ireland, who died around the same time as the Jesuit Father Joseph Marmion. And they had a conversation the night before about maybe people believe it was their brother, but they just wanted to point out they had no connection. But then the name was raised in relation to a number of other events, and then we had people who worked with him when he was in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin. That was long after the Jesuits admit that they were told about his sexual abuse of children. That was 10 years after. He was still a Jesuit ministering as a chaplain in a hospital in Dublin, and a number of other people who came across him and described him in similar terms to what's been described today. Tom Dooley, what do you think should happen next?
I have to say, I think what the Jesuits so far have done has been commendable, but I think it's incomplete. I think they probably need to reflect in their conscience, their collective conscience, and take credit for what they've done so far, but to actually disclose what was known and when. What we have at this stage is a very welcome acknowledgement of dreadful crimes. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Joe, the phrase they used wasn't allegations, the phrase is disclosures, and that's good. Mm-hmm. But we don't have the whole story. And I think for those of his targets who have survived, and we have to acknowledge, as you say, that some people, I'm sure, haven't, those people, I think, can take some comfort from what has happened so far. Yeah. But there's a longer road, and I think they should man up, and as men for others, which is their motto, so to speak. And clean.
Who was the principal or the headmaster, as they called them, in Belvedere at that time, Tom?
That was a man called Father Barber, for whom I have a lot of time, and who.
Do you reckon he was intimidated by Marmion?
I've no doubt, because as somebody said to me, when he, as headmaster, crossed the yard from the school where he was the boss and went into Belvedere House, he was actually a very junior member of that community. Marmion was a very senior one, and a very menacing one. Now, having said that, I think, and again, as I understand it, I don't have facts, but my understanding is that Father Barber encountered resistance within the community to dealing with
taking them on,
Marmion, when it was very clear that it had to be done, and when it was very clear it had to be done, he did take it on. So I think some credit is due there.
Okay, 1857 15 815. Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You say quite clearly, and I know you want to make a wider point, which please do, but you say quite clearly he was evil. Marmion was evil.
Yeah, he picked on the most vulnerable in class, somebody who had very little security and was obviously intimidated by him. Mm-hmm. And he would stand over the desk. He didn't teach me a subject.
Okay.
But if we had a teacher who was out missing or on a course day or something, he would step in, and he was somebody that people dreaded. However, I would be very quick to say, I never saw or heard of any sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it did or didn't happen.
Okay. Yeah,
just never heard of it. But I know from a point of view of, he seemed to take delight in terrifying people and would stand at the desk while everybody else would look away. In case he'd stare at them and pick on them, he would intimidate people to the point of tears. And, you know, he would be very careful not to pick on the big lads. He'd pick on the smaller, more vulnerable in the group. But my whole thing when this broke the other day...
Yeah.
I had a huge number of very, very respected priests in Belvedere.
Yes, yeah.
I am not going to mention any of them because it would pick out one rather than the others.
Yeah.
And the previous caller there to mention Father Barber, well, I was of an era where I left in 71, and Father Barber only came in as principal after I left.
Mm-hmm.
But the previous prefect of studies was the epitome of gentlemen, kind, helpful, and the absolute, there would be not a bone in his body that could be described as evil. And I'm sure the other gentleman knows who I'm talking about.
Okay.
But my big sadness is that somebody could come along while most of these priests who taught us in school have since passed on, that I would hate to think of somebody coming along and making an accusation against somebody who can't defend themselves because they're gone. And I think that's kind of a dangerous, sorry road we would go down.
And remember the statement from the Jesuits in Ireland, they are quite clear that as far as they're concerned, these allegations against Joseph Marmion are proven and are true.
I absolutely accept. And the head of the Jesuits here, Leonard, he was in school when I was there. He was a priest in there as well, as was a lot of others who are still around and quite famous ones as well. But I just hope that the respect that I had and lots of others had for the various priests in the school who were good people won't be tarnished by what's going on here.
Okay.
And it's dreadful. I do know he was a bully, but I don't know of anything further.
Okay.
Joe, can I comment on that, please?
Yeah, Mark Harold, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, because of the 45-year silence, I'm afraid those decent men's reputation was tarnished because they sat on their hands, because they did nothing. That's why, and that really hurts me because I agree with that man. There were very many decent Jesuits in that community. But because a collective decision was made that this chap was given carte blanche, for whatever reason, whether he was intimidating or what, he destroyed children's lives. And he was left at it for 10 years. So I do, you know, I am concerned for the, because, and I'm sure they are feeling very, very compromised and hurt by it. But it took 45 years.
Yes, that's very regrettable. And nobody would be proud of that. But I think you know who I'm talking about, the Prefect of Studies before Father Barber, a lovely, lovely gentleman who unfortunately died in Milton Park some good years ago. As to what the involvement was or wasn't, I don't know. But I would feel dreadfully saddened by his reputation and that of others of being tarnished by a 45-year silence or possibly more.
Eugene Cranley is on the line. Eugene is in Malta at the moment. Eugene, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Your point, please, Eugene.
Yes, well, I just wanted to put a sense of balance, and I apologise in advance because my hearing isn't so good.
Okay.
But I'm hoping I'm coming across okay there. I left Belvedere in 1967, and I was... obviously shocked to hear about it on Morning Ireland yesterday and then hearing your programme. And I totally believe what happened there. I'm not in any way denying. I just want to put a sense of balance there. In my years, and strangely enough, that first gentleman, we have something in common because I was actually a lead soprano, boy soprano, in a couple of operas there. Incidentally, your colleague John Bowman was Mikado when I was Yum Yum.
So, and Eugene was, when you were there, was in the shows, was Marmion in charge?
No, he wasn't there. I left in 1967, so I've never heard of the man. And my involvement in school and in operas, had no such unhappy memories of dreadful things. And school was harsh in those days, there was no doubt about it. But I just wanted to ring in and say, and I've no past involvement with Belvedere. I'm sad to say I was never a star on the rugby field. I wasn't a member of Belvedere Union.
Eugene, you used the word balance there. I'm a bit at a loss as to what your why do you think is imbalanced? People are telling their stories and just in terms of the reputation, do you think the reputation of the school will suffer Belvedere?
Because yes, I do.
But you can't get anything you read about Belvedere is you can't get into it because there's so much demand, even though it's fee-paying. Do you think that...
Fine.
Do you think the reputation of the school is going to be damaged?
No, I want to say that I went through both schools of junior school and senior school, and I had no such bad... I mean, there was harsh punishments and all that, but... the school and the priest, I could remember, I wrote actually yesterday to the rector, because I've never been in touch with them since.
Okay.
And yet I felt obliged to write and remember the names of priests like Father Smith, Father Mick Reedy, Father Oliver O'Brien, great priests who gave inspiration to me. Father Scully, who found the
housing association in Berlin. Yeah. But you, Eugene, and we know their involvement with the Belvedere Youth Club and the incredible work of people like Fergus McCabe and over the years. But Eugene. And we'll forget the names of the people you mentioned because they've no relevance to this next point, which was made by Mark Harald a few minutes ago. If they were Jesuits and given their vocation and profession of faith, men for others, the Ignatian motto, they not have an obligation, given that what Marmion was doing, I'm not talking about those names you mentioned, but did his confreres not have an obligation if they were there, and it seems, as people are saying, the dogs in the street knew what Marmion was up to actually, in some shape or form, challenge this man? And even ring the guard, one of them to ring the Gardaí.
Yes, I'm sure there were mistakes made. I'm sure there was, but all I can say is that one has to, you know, not kill all.
Yeah, I don't think anyone is.
The memories and the wonderful work that Jesuits do throughout the world, and particularly in schools. I mean, I don't know their motto. There is some famous motto about. Give me a child and I'll create a... I can't remember the exact words.
Yeah.
But they had a wonderful ethos. And I grew up in Finglas Road in Glasnevin. Again, wonderful, lucky home. Mm-hmm. Living right beside a big Christian Brothers school, whose name I won't mention. But that was a dreadful place. And immense cruelty done to friends of mine who I lived on. That road. But I'm just saying that I was lucky. My parents were wonderful to pay and put us through that school. And yes, there were bad times, but my overall impression, and I'm internally grateful to them for a certain amount of what I can only describe in my later years as love and caring. Okay. And I don't write letters very often, but I wrote to the rector yesterday to just offer a word of support. And I just feel that.
Okay, I take that point. And that's,
Joe, Tom, will you
let you reply and engage in conversation because I have more people. Eugene hopefully will stay there. People who were students in the Crescent in Limerick where Marmion also taught after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Talking about Father Joseph Marmion, who was a Jesuit order in Ireland, issued a statement yesterday saying he was a paedophile, he abused children. They said they first heard about him in 1977. They then moved him around for a decade afterwards. And even though they accept that he was guilty of crimes, and we've been talking to survivors of Joseph Marmion and also other people who past pupils of Clongowes and indeed Belvedere College. Barry McLaughlin is in Austria. Barry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You were in the Crescent in Limerick, and what was your experience of this man?
Well, I was there from 56 to 67, and in primary, in the Crescent Primary, Joe Marmion arrived as a scholastic. That is, he hadn't been ordained.
Okay.
And he'd a certain cachet because he was English and he was the nephew of a blessed Dom Marmion.
That's right, yeah.
But he was obviously a sadist. And I remember in one music class, he threw me out, thankfully, because he said I couldn't sing, which is untrue. But he punished me one day by... We're all in short trousers, you know. He'd call it the old one, too. He'd give you a fierce slap with his hand on your spindly thigh, you know.
Yeah.
And later on, then he came back. He had been in the late 60s. He was now a full Jesuit. He'd been commissioned, if you like, in the army, and he was an officer. And I had him as an English teacher, and he left me alone. He liked me because I was very good at English. But I learned years later, I was very shocked by this, although wasn't particularly... Well, I was surprised, but what's coming out now doesn't surprise me, of course, because a friend who was much younger told me, and he was at the Crescent, I suppose it could have been after I'd left it, that he'd been raped by Marmion, victim, who died in 1999, quite young. He was a social worker in London. Earlier, he'd been a social worker in Dublin, and he'd heard about these carryings on in Belvedere, and he told me, he approached him, and he said, if this man isn't removed, I'm going to the guards. So I don't know if there's any record of something like that happening, but I was absolutely shocked by what my friend told me. So I wasn't particularly shocked by the stories that have come out, but he was a very intimidating, bulky, evil person.
As you say, you heard of us. This is in the context, Barry, that the Jesuit order themselves, they say, we're making public the name of a former teacher and priest, Father Joseph Marmion, the Society of Jesus, who abused boys sexually, emotionally and physically while he was... There's no doubt there. They're saying it categorically. They now know. And you say you heard of a case where he had raped...
The victim himself told me this over a few beers in Limerick, about 25 years ago, and I nearly fell off the stool, Joe.
Yeah.
You know, the Jesuits, I was listening to the previous caller. I have a very kind of jaundiced view of them, really, because they kind of, like all priests, they try to control you. And the only Jesuit that I met in my time, and he's forgotten about in Ireland now, and I really respected, was Bob Thompson, who started a liberal newspaper in Northern Rhodesia under British rule, was a personal friend of Kenneth Kaunda's. He was a fantastic person. But a lot of them, you could see, they were unhappy with themselves. They didn't like one another. They were all living in this gloomy Georgian mansion in Limerick. And I was delighted
Why do you say they didn't like one another, Barry?
This would come across in remarks, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them. It would come across in remarks, you know. Oh, was he in today? That fella kind of, you know. Because there are strong personalities and, there's another side to priestly life as well.
I know.
You know, you think about these things when you're older. You don't have the time, but... And a miserable life it must have been for some of them. If they weren't interested in rugby, or musicals or whatever, if they're intellectual men or sensitive men, you know.
Which we're told is the Jesuit formation. Stay with us if you can, Barry. Doreena McKeown, Doreena, your family is...
Hello, Joe.
Yeah, as you say, we are family of Jesuits. Go ahead, Doreena. Yeah,
my mum had four brothers, three of whom were Jesuits. And the last one, Uncle Michael Kelly, died 6 weeks ago from COVID Zambia. Yeah, an incredible man.
Yeah.
An intellectual man, a quiet man, a humble man, a world-renowned man for his work with HIV and AIDS. Incredible man. The other two, Uncle Robert was in Zambia also. He went before Michael. And Joe was the chaplain to the Actors Chapel in Broadway in New York.
Okay.
And he taught in Belvedere, and he taught rugby, and he taught English. Joe did before he went to America. But they were incredible men. My family have all been educated by them. My children have been educated, and I've never yet come across somebody like that terrible man they're talking about, Father Marmion. I believe every word of it, but it's dreadful. And I'm glad my uncle's gone, because he would absolutely die if he thought this was going on in his community.
And was Joe Roberts and Michael, who and condolences on his passing
Thank
only
you.
6 weeks ago from COVID, were they brothers? They were three
we're
siblings.
All brothers, yeah. Three siblings, yeah. My mother had four brothers and three of them were Jesuits.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. So we were very proud of them. They were fantastic men. And I am so sorry for those people that have been abused by that man. It's horrific. But any I have known, and certainly my own family, were very, very proud of my uncles, the three of them. You know?
Okay.
There are
okay.
good men. There are very good men.
I know, that's
men.
Been said again and again and again.
Yeah. And I would hate to think that everyone thinks the Jesuits are all the same, because they're not.
No, but well, people are in this day and age are very sophisticated in their thinking, in terms of they don't tarnish everybody.
Tarnish everyone.
Yeah.
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 Good.
Okay, and where was Michael buried, Doreen?
Michael was buried in Lusaka.
Jesuits
in Lusaka. I went out 3 years ago to surprise him with my son. We'd never been out.
Okay.
And we had a lovely time. We met all the other Jesuits out there. And when he died, the embassy and the Jesuits between them videoed everything for us. And we watched the mass online. And they organized flowers for us and photographs and everything. It was it couldn't have been nicer.
Okay. And there's an...
Yeah.
I'm just, as I've been handed now, pieces that were written about your uncle, and he was an incredible man.
He was.
By all accounts, an incredible man, and especially in his work around, he was renowned for his work around HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And
he had honorary degrees from a lot of universities here in Ireland and from all over the world. Yeah, incredible man.
And in 2020, he appeared on an Irish postage stamp. Is that the same man?
That is the same.
Thanks indeed, Doreena. Barry Carroll. Thanks, Doreena. Barry Carroll.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And you went to Belvedere. Is that correct?
I'm very lucky to have survived it, Joe.
Tell us why.
When I was 10 years old, a priest from a very poor background, because the Jesuits do social justice, put the nickname Princess on me.
Princess.
Because I was a nice-looking boy with beautiful manners, very polite. My father was a distinguished man in South Dublin. We were part of the, what would you call us, upper middle class, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And that name stuck like glue. I was called Princess Barry for 6 years. Teachers heard me being called it. They never, ever said, stop that. I developed stomach ulcers. I was kicked downstairs. I was spat at by 500 boys. And in the end, on doctor's orders, I was removed.
Oh, God.
Now, the Jesuits have made a settlement with me 40 years later.
Okay.
And that what took a great deal of effort on my part, Joe.
And Barry, bear with me for a sec, Barry. I just need to take one more break and then I'll give you all the time available.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We've been talking about Father Joseph Marmion for most of the programme, and indeed a lot of yesterday's programme. Barry is talking about another episode and his experience in Belvedere. You were nicknamed Princess by one of the Jesuits in Belvedere.
I was, and not only that, but he encouraged the other boys to use it. And I'll tell you why he did it. Because he came from a desperately poor family.
Mm-hmm.
The Jesuits paid for his education.
Yeah.
He saw me. I mean, I don't know whether you've seen the photograph, but I've got a photograph, extremely good looking.
Okay.
Perhaps a little bit fey, beautifully spoken, perfect manners, and I came as an object of hate to him. I also believe he was sexually attracted to me.
And Barry, what prompted you then to go back to the Jesuits and take it up with them, so to speak?
I'll tell you what that was.
Yeah.
When I started to read about all their social justice, I thought I must try and do something.
Okay.
And I must explain one thing. The school today is absolutely, totally different from what I experienced.
Okay.
It was a place of fear. Not so much the junior school, because the parents had to pay for the junior school.
And the junior school is now gone.
Now, this is the thing the Jesuits should never have done, because they used to say, give us a boy at seven, he's ours for life.
Yeah.
It's all to do with money, Joe. anyway.
And what about Barry, what age were you when you left Belvedere?
Well, I was 16. I was a head case.
Sounds like you were carried out of Belvedere.
Almost. When my parents took me, they immediately took me to a private doctor in Fitzwilliam Square. He had his own x-ray machine because I was in such pain. And do you know what he said when he saw me?
Mm.
Where do you go to school? I said, Belvedere. He said, I was in that prison, boy. I was in that prison. Anyway, he x-rayed me and there was a big ulcer.
Okay.
Now, today they have very quick treatment for ulcers, but in those days it was bed rest.
And where did you go, just finally, Barry, because I'm at, where did you go when you were 16? Did you stay in education? I hope you did.
Yeah, I did. Mr. Kevin Kelleher, he was a rugby international referee, he took me into St. Conlon's College.
Ah, yes, St. Conlon's in Dublin.
If he hadn't taken me in, I just dread to think what would have happened.
Okay.
And but also, I should explain that in class I was called Princess, and one boy put the nickname Lily, Princess Lily. Oh, it was great fun with Princess Lily around.
And you were bullied and bullied.
The lay teachers never said stop.
Okay.
And even the nice Jesuits, because I will be fair, there were some very nice Jesuits, and I'm not unfair.
Okay.
They used to say, settle down, lad, settle down, lad.
Okay. Okay, Barry, I'm out of time, but it's very important and worthwhile hearing from you. Stay safe, Barry, and stay well. Thank you indeed. And I see more, and apologies to the other callers who want to talk about their treatment at the hands of Father Joseph Marmion. Shannon Gorman, producer, Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Sorento plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.